heart. But lo means mind. Also, it can mean intellect, something like that. There are two Tibetan words for mind, sem and lo. And sem usually has to do with mind as an entity, my mind, kind of like thing. And lo is a little bit more like what the mind can do, or maybe its properties, like intellect. But in fact, lo and sem are, we could call them synonyms. They're so much alike. And lo or sem can mean mind. It can mean a thought, that kind of thing. It can mean, oh, I don't know. Well, we'll have those two, mind, thought, maybe intention even. Sem also means intention, and lo can mean intention as well. And then jong means to make pure. It's related to jong, you know, like sem jong or jong chup or something like that. But it has the idea of making pure. It also has the idea of learning to do something, practicing something, you know, like learning to play the piano, learning to play a sport, things like that. Now, if we use the idea of Lojong as meaning developing the good heart, sort of suggests that we have to radically change our behavior, change our mind. And that's why mind training is a good translation for Lojong. Mind practice is kind of a literal translation. And this kind of teaching, and Lojong is a genre of texts in the Tibetan canon. We don't find any really in the Tengyur or the Kangyur, even though Lord Buddha talks about it all the time. But developing the good heart has to do with changing the way that we react towards others, the way that we see other people. What that means is that we have to learn to always see others as helpers or as holy beings. And that's kind of a hard thing to do. Now, all of you have been in this business long enough to have begun to do that yourselves. And hopefully you've experienced some of the results of having done that. But Lojong has to do with how we relate to other people, meaning what does our mind do, you know, when we're around other people. We develop karma in relationship to other people, where people is a general meaning, like dogs and horses as well as human beings. We don't really generate karma with a relationship to inanimate objects like rocks or cards or anything else. Even though I guess, you know, we can have desire for a nice car or something like that, or a precious gem. But basically, we develop karma. We generate karma in a relationship to other people. And in order to reach enlightenment, we have to generate the karma to be able to do that. So other people are key for us reaching enlightenment. That's the real bottom line here. And to reach enlightenment, We first of all have to rid ourselves, excuse me, rid ourselves of all of our mental, there, to rid ourselves of all of our mental afflictions. And second of all, we have to remove all of our obstacles to omniscience. And we do that also in relationship to other people. And what we have to do is develop pure views of other people. We have to learn to change our mind in relationship to how we view others. And that is developing the good heart. What is necessary for us to reach enlightenment? Bodhicitta. We can rid ourselves of mental afflictions without bodhicitta, you know, and that's the goal of the lower path, of the Hinayana path. But in order to reach enlightenment, we have to have bodhicitta, meaning this great compassion. I will take upon myself the responsibility for getting everybody else enlightened. And to do that, you need lots and lots of love. You have to treat others well. You have to want to treat others well. I was impressed with what somebody said at the retreat in Guadalajara. This was a man from Mexico. He was talking about a center in Mexico City. There are three of them, three ACI centers in Mexico City. But one was located in an area of very, very poor people, where it wasn't just poverty, but mental illness and bodily deformations as well. And he was talking about the opportunity that they found themselves presented with when they started this, you know, with dealing, caring for people who were physically repulsive, you know, who were ugly or deformed or, you know, would turn your stomach just to look at them, to be around them, you know, as well as those who are mentally ill, you know, whose behavior is the kind of thing that really makes you not want to be around them, you know. And so they had the opportunity to watch their minds, and they had the maturity to be able to do that, you know, when they were dealing with this kind of people and how that helped them grow. And, you know, and this is sort of the basis of mind training, is training our mind to respond appropriately to people who normally we wouldn't want to be around or want to like. We have to learn to love them. We have to learn to put them above ourselves. Their existence, their happiness, is much more important than our own. So this is sort of a nutshell of what Lojong is about. We begin to realize, you know, that we're all in the same boat. We're all in the same situation. Everybody around us is dying. And as you get older, that happens more frequently to you because people your age or younger than you are dying. And we've been doing this all since beginningless time. And we have to understand that everybody else is suffering. We have to understand that we ourselves are suffering, even when we don't think that we are. Why is that? Because basically everything we do creates the causes for us to die and be reborn, usually not in a very good place. And at this point, you know, in our training, we kind of have to pat ourselves in the back, you know, pat Joe on the back for this really good human rebirth. And the fact that we're doing things now, you know, to prepare ourselves for another good human rebirth, or even to the point where we won't die, you know, we will change into a light body and become an enlightened being. And in order to to develop this kind of attitude, we have to understand that everybody else is suffering. We're all in the same situation. We're not different from anybody else. Everybody wants to be happy, and everybody does the things that make sure that they aren't happy, ourselves included. So what we have to do is jong, the lojong. We have to jong this feeling. We have to practice this feeling. We have to train ourselves to understand this feeling with a relationship to ourselves, but especially to others. We have to develop the feeling all day long. A month or two ago, I think I was at a board meeting for the fire department, and there was a lady there who has sort of taken it upon herself to get everybody to go to church on Sunday, right? And it had to do with this Sunday business, that you've got to come to church, you've got to do this, you know? And it was like that there was a great moral failing if you didn't go to church on Sunday. And I was thinking about that, you know. She didn't say this to me, but she would, you know. Why don't you go to church on Sunday? You know that you're going to go to hell if you don't. And, you know, as a Buddhist, we basically go to church every day, you know, when we do our practice. But more importantly, the goal of our practice, the goal of mind training, is to really be in church all day long. There isn't a moment when we're not thinking about the welfare of others. You know, how do I help other people? How do I see these difficult people as enlightened beings? How do I see difficult people as teachers to help me learn to do something, to not get angry, for example, or to not be jealous? And we do this all day long. We have to love other people all day long. We have to have great compassion for them all day long, 24/7. You know, but the problem is that we waste our time trying to get the things that we want for ourselves. And we don't think about others. And, you know, even when we're in retreat, you know, we lose this idea of thinking about others because we're focused on ourselves. In retreat, especially a tantric retreat, you're very inner all the time. You're thinking about your mind or yourself or how you change, you know, how you develop a good heart. And there's nobody else around for you to have to interact with. So even in retreat, we face problems about keeping this good heart, this bodhicitta in our minds. So, you know, we learn after a while that there's no point to be selfish, meaning to just care for ourselves. Why? Because in the end, we're going to die, and it will have gotten us nothing. Cherishing ourselves is not going to get us a good rebirth. Cherishing ourselves is not going to get us to nirvana. Cherishing ourselves is not going to get us to enlightenment. And I'm talking about the ignorant cherishing of ourselves, you know, this idea that I have to take care of me and that the me exists truly, you know, from its own side. We have to change our attitude toward that. We have to change our hearts. And this is the developing the good heart idea. You know, why not be good to other people? Why not love other people? And it takes practice. It takes lots and lots of practice to develop this. So that's what Lojong is about. So Lojong means mind training. We can translate it as developing the good heart. It means also developing the wish for enlightenment. You know, when we take our bodhisattva vows, we are committing ourselves, first of all, to develop this wish. You know, I want to get enlightened. Why? So that I can lead everybody else to enlightenment. And this doesn't come automatically. We have to work at it. And developing the wish, I mean, making that wish real, is in fact a Lojong practice. Lojong has been around. We're going to take a look at the first part of the eight first mind training today, which was written by Diamond Lightened. And he lived in the 11th century, 1054 to 1123. I'll give you these dates later. So it's been around, 1,000 years, something like that. And various people have written Lojong texts, and they're always very short, during that 1,000 years. And Chökyi Rinpoche, we've talked about Chökyi Rinpoche before. He lived, 1642 to 1714. The Chankya lineage was a line of people who were teachers to the emperors of China. They were in the Forbidden City teaching Buddhism to Chinese emperors. And eventually, as the relationship between China and Tibet began to sour, this relationship finished. Chankya was one of the last ones in this lineage. Pabunka Rinpoche is of this lineage, but by the time Pabunka was born, the relationship had deteriorated so much that instead of being a Chankya, he, I don't know whether it was him, it was probably his teachers, decided that he would be a Pabunka lineage instead. They gave him that new name. But Chökyi defined Rinpoche, defined Lojong as he was talking about Diamond Lion, who wrote this text that we're going to study. And Chökyi Rinpoche said, Diamond Lion from the Langri Tangpa region, who was a highly realized bodhisattva, made the book in eight verses, the personal religious instruction on developing the wish to reach Buddhahood to help all beings. Now, this work, this eight verses, is one of the most famous of the Lojong texts. It's very, very short, eight verses, right? But it says a lot. And one of the words in this is Dampa. Dampa means religious instruction. So the eight verses is a religious instruction. And typically, Dampas is a kind of instruction that is, in fact, whispered. It's passed on. A teacher whispers the instruction to his student or her student in a very holy moment, like during an empowerment or during a retreat or during a time where the teacher has prepared the student and they spent an hour, say, you know, getting their minds very, very clear. And then the teacher whispers an instruction. So the eight verses is that kind of a teaching. When you reach a particular level, when you've been practicing a while, it turns out that everything that you hear becomes a dhamma. It becomes an instruction. And training means, the mind training part, the jhana of lojong, means that you have to work hard to reach this level. Chökyi Rinpoche calls the eight verses a semjong. That's his name. Semjong instead of lojong. He's using sem instead of lo to indicate that the goal of Buddhism, you know, is to develop the ultimate form of compassion, you know, jangchup, or jangchup kisem, bodhicitta. That's the goal of Buddhism. And that's what lojong will do for you, the mind training. You know, when you take your bodhisattva vows, you promise to do the things that bodhisattvas do to get yourself enlightened. And what do bodhisattvas do? They study the six perfections. They do the six perfections. What happens? They train their minds, lojong. They develop the good heart. They develop bodhicitta. So the lojong teachings show you how to do this. They're one way. And lojong is an important thing after you've been practicing and studying for a while, because you really know now what needs to happen in your mind. You learn that we're all dying. We learn, we know, we know in our heart that every good thing that we experience will go away. We learn that every good thing we experience only happens because we've given that good thing to somebody else in the past. We learn that we must be good to others in order to be happy ourselves. And then we try to love them. You know, we serve them. We try to serve them. We get better and better at it. And as we do this, our mind changes. And this is why we call lojong developing the good heart. Lo is a code word for bodhicitta, which is the wish to reach enlightenment, you know, so that we can help other people. Let's head on toward the eight-verse mind training. It was written by a Geshe named Diamond Lion, or Dorje Senge. Senge is lion in Tibetan, and Dorje is diamond. And his dates are 1054 to 1123. And he wrote one of the most famous lojong texts, the eight verses of mind training. Now, he was a Kadampa. They were the first generation of Buddhists in Tibet. The Kadampas came into being when Lord Atisha came from India to Tibet and started the monastic tradition. The lojong kinds of texts were very popular amongst the Kadampas. Diamond Lion is also called Geshe Langri Tangpa. Langri Tangpa is a region in Tibet. It's on the plains, plains area of Tibet. After you cross over the Himalayas, you know, going from India to Tibet, you're in kind of a level area, a plains area. Now, that plains area is about 3,000 meters high. But it's fairly level, and there are areas that are more level than others, and there are also mountains around too, even after you've crossed over the Himalayas. Langri Tangpa is what is an area in one of these plains regions. Now, part of his name that was given by Chökyi Rinpoche was Sempa Chenpo. Sempa means mind, really, and Chenpo means great. So he was a highly realized bodhisattva, and he was one of the first Geshes. Geshe literally means spiritual friend. The title Geshe is being sort of a degree didn't come into use until after Jeitsongkhapa's time, maybe during his time, you know, where you reached, you got your Geshe degree in the Gelugpa lineage. But before that time, a Geshe was a spiritual friend. And anybody around you who helps you is a Geshe for you. So keep that in mind. So part of the name of this text is the Lojong in 8 verses. Tsik Gyeba. Tsik means verse. Gye means 8. And the 8, like the 8 verses, would be normally Gyepa, the 8. But here it's Gyema. Ma is a feminine ending. And it's in Tibetan, when words are given feminine endings and they don't refer to a lady, it has to do with wisdom, the feminine side. So the Lojong in 8 verses, the Tsik Gyema, means that these are 8 verses having to do with wisdom or developing wisdom. This 8 verses is found in a collection of Lojong texts called Lojong Gyatsa. Gya means 100 and Sa means root text or main or root. It isn't really 100 verses, but it's lots, okay? So this is a compendium of Lojong texts, Lojong Gyatsa. And it was put together by a monk named Munchen Kunchuk Gyeltsen during the 14th century. So the first verse of the 8 verses of mind training, in English it says, "May I think of every living being as more precious than a wish-giving gem for reaching the ultimate goal, and so always hold them dear." So the first line starts with Dak. Dak means self or me. The second year I was in Italy, His Holiness gave a teaching on this text in London, and several of us went up. And His Holiness read us the first verse. And then he said, "Well, this line, the first word here means self, which is very important. So before we begin to talk about the self, maybe we should talk a little bit about what Dak means to us." He taught for 3 days, twice a day. So there were 6 classes. The first 5 classes, he was talking about Dak. And then in the 6th class, the last one, he covered the 8 verses. So Dak's important. We've talked about Dak a lot. But what is this self? The self is kind of the nature of something. You know, the Dak of a pen is pen, which is an idea, pen, right? Typically, we understand in our minds that the self of something comes from its own side. You know, like the pen, the dak. Pen is a pen independent of my projection of it being a pen. When I'm beholding the pen, that object I'm beholding exists from its own side. It has a self, dak. And that self is pen. Now, of course, we know that that's not true, that there is no pen from its own side, independent of our projection of it. That kind of a pen, that self, does not exist in any way at all. Is there a pen there? There certainly is. How does it exist? As a projection of our mind. Does it have a nature of being a pen? Yes, Does that nature come from the pen? No, it does not. It comes from our mind. So this idea of self applies to us as well. You know, we think that the self, whoever we are, sort of exists all by its own. And we have to take care of that. That's kind of a contradiction, really. You know, if the self existed all by its own, we wouldn't have to take care of it, really. But this self is very important to us. Is there a self? Well, yeah. Where does it come from? My projection. Is there a venerable Phil from its own side? No, there is not. Is there a venerable Phil? Yes. I have an idea of venerable Phil from my side. That's not the same thing as the venerable Phil that you think of, but they're similar. And they're selves. But this doc, you know, may this self think of every living being has to do with may I change my conception of how I view others. So may I think of every living being as more precious than a wish-giving gem. Those are the first two lines. And we can understand these two lines in three different ways. The first one has to do with how we view the world, how we view others in particular, but how we view the world. Right now, we can't even conceive of how nice it's going to be when we reach our tantric enlightenment. You know, even if somebody were to explain it to you, you wouldn't understand it. You wouldn't be able to think about what that would really be like. You know, and that's why Tantra is secret. It's a self-protecting secret. It is secret in one way because even if you hear the words, you don't understand them. You don't understand the meaning of them. Why? Because you don't yet have the karma to have that experience. It's hard for us to even imagine how we might get there. It's hard for us to imagine the steps that we have to do before you begin to have some realizations. At this point in your spiritual career, you've probably had some realizations. Maybe some rather profound ones, maybe some like, oh, I never thought about that before, you know, that kind of thing. It's these kind of things that happen on our spiritual path. This is what we're after. You know, when you take the wishing vow, the bodhicitta wishing vow, you may not even know what you're wishing for. It seems like a good idea. And so you do it. But in terms of what happens, for example, the understanding of bodhicitta you have when you have a direct perception of emptiness, right now you probably don't have even an inkling of what that kind of idea is. You don't know what you're wishing for. You don't really understand what might bring you to tantric enlightenment. What would be, you know, and that tantric enlightenment would be better than a wish-giving gem for you. Because you're actually there. You're experiencing that. And that's important. You know, this is one way to think about it. Right now, we don't understand what it would be like, you know, to reach tantric enlightenment. We do want to do it to various degrees, but it's difficult for us to think about it. So, you know, the people around us then are going to help us do that. You know, the third and fourth line, you know, basically has to do, these people are going to get me to heaven. And then we love them. We say to them when we're around them, I love you. You know, thank you. Test me. Please test me. Make me learn to be kind. This is what Geshe-la sort of phrased the third and fourth lines of this first verse, is what it means. So the people around us are dear to us. They are going to show us how to change our minds. When somebody makes us angry or we're jealous of somebody, you know, we hold those people dear to us because they are showing us how to view them in a different way. We reach the point, you know, that when we get angry at somebody, we know that's not coming from them, it's coming from us. And we think, ah, okay, now what did I do to make this anger occur? How do I change my mind so when this thing happens again to me, that I don't get angry, but instead I think, ah, that's just me. This person is showing me how to not be angry. And because of that, I need to be kind to them and thank them for helping me. And, you know, at first we just sort of grit our teeth, you know, and maybe don't yell back at a person who yells at us. But as we get more and more proficient with that, then we begin to think and we engage ourselves in a conversation with them. You know, did I do something to make you angry? I'm sorry if I did that. And we develop love for them instead. And we have to understand then that these are holy beings. Okay. They are Buddhas who are there doing what they're doing to help us change our mind. And so these kind of beings are very, very precious to us. You know, think about Lord Maitreya appearing to Master Asanga as a smelly, dying, maggot-infested dog. You know, something really repulsive. To help him develop bodhicitta. You know, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Now, another way of understanding this, these first two lines, you know, which are, may I think of every being, living being is more precious than a wish-giving gem. The state of mind that we call bodhicitta, you know, ultimate compassion, great compassion. That state of mind wants to reach the highest goal, which is enlightenment. And that state of mind is more precious to us than a wish-giving gem. And a third way to understand the first two lines here is that Buddhahood itself is better than a wish-giving gem. So these first two lines, may I think of every living being as more precious than a wish-giving gem. One way is we have a hard time understanding what tantric enlightenment would be like for us. And these people are helping us develop that understanding. And the second way is the bodhicitta, achieving that, wanting to reach the highest goal, is more precious to us than a wish-giving gem. And the third way is that Buddhahood itself is more precious than a wish-giving gem. So we'll move on to verse 2. When I'm with another, wherever we are, may I see myself as the lowest. May I hold the other as highest from the bottom of my heart. So this is, there's a book called The Jew in the Lotus. And it's a series of notes about a meeting that His Holiness had with members of different Jewish traditions. He called them to Dharamsala to meet with them. He wanted basically to understand how they had managed to keep their tradition going for 2,000 years, having having been ejected from their homeland, you know. And His Holiness was interested in that because that's the situation of the Tibetans now, too. So the there were four different representative from four different Jewish traditions that were there, and they had been briefed by members of His Holiness staff, you know, that when His Holiness comes into the room, he is going to view himself as the lowest, the least person there, and view everybody else as higher than him. And that's applying the second verse. These Jewish leaders were told that because while he may seem very simple to them, that he's not. You know, he's simply practicing bodhicitta, practicing love. He wants to learn something, you know, from these leaders. So we have to understand that this doesn't mean that this kind of a thing is an exercise in low self-esteem. It doesn't mean that you understand that you can't do anything. It means the opposite. You are there because everybody else around you is helping you get enlightened. That's their purpose. And as you progress toward your goal, as you're progressing towards Tantra, and after you begin Tantric practice, you change your view that everything around you is pure. Everybody around you is there to help you get enlightened. And that's what this means. You know, wherever I am, you know, whoever I'm with, may I see myself as the lowest of all, meaning that everybody else is higher than I am. They are enlightened beings. They're showing me what to do. And may I see others then as the best. Now, according to the scriptures then, wherever you are, you know, there should be a few difficult people in every crowd. You know, it's no problem for them to be there. They're enlightened beings. They see that, right now, if I'm there and do something to make this person angry or jealous or whatever mental affliction might be there, I will help them understand that that's not the proper way and to change their minds so that those thoughts don't occur. That's what this verse is about, you know. So we're understanding that around us, every day, all day long, there are going to be people who are already enlightened, you know, and they're trying very hard to get us enlightened ourselves. Typically, they're going to be difficult, but they don't have to be. They can be people who love you, people who make you feel good about yourself, for example. People who need help and you're there when you're at the point that you can give them that help lovingly, understanding that you are actually progressing toward enlightenment yourself. Verse 3. As I go through the day, may I watch my mind to see if a negative thought has come. If it does, may I stop it right there with force, since it hurts myself and others. So, as you've probably figured out by now, you're going to have bad days or bad moments, you know. You are going to have bad thoughts. When they occur, you've got to stop them immediately, or at least try to do that, you know. The minute that you begin to get angry at somebody or feel bad, you know, about somebody else, you've got to try to stop that. The first thing that you have to do is understand that that's what's happening to you, that you are getting in a bad mental state with relationship to somebody else. And you admit that the problem is yours. It's not theirs. You know, whatever they're showing you is not their problem. It's coming from you. And they are there to make that happen, make that thing occur in you. They are the stimulus to make that kind of thought come up. And then when it does, you begin to understand it and say, oh, that's from me, right? And understand that it's your problem. And as you begin to do this and you do it more and more and more, then you begin to see these people in a different way. You begin to feel compassion for them. You begin to feel love for them as well. You know, it's very important. These people are suffering the same as we are. That's what we have to understand. Now, of course, they're enlightened beings. We have to view them that way. But they are demonstrating, they are manifesting suffering, which we perceive. And we change our minds to be able to respond to them in an appropriate way. We want to help them. We don't want to get rid of them, for example. And we begin to understand the laws of karma. We begin to understand personally that even a slight moment of irritation keeps us from our goal. And that begins to come evident. You've probably experienced it yourself at some time or other, or maybe you experience it often now. That would be really great. But we begin to understand how the effects of our reactions to other people, what kind of effect that has on our own future. You know, if we're loving and compassionate toward others, then our future enlightenment is getting closer and closer and closer. If we still get upset or peeved at somebody, then our enlightenment is not getting closer. And it may, depending on how angry or whatever it is we are, it may be getting further and further away for us. But this begins to happen. As we begin this kind of practice, our mind does begin to change. And then verse 4. At times I will meet bad people, tormented by strong bad deeds and pain. They are hard to find, like a mine of gold. And so may I hold them dear. So it says bad people are hard to find. Right. We probably encounter them all the time. But what does this mean? What it means is that when we're able to react to bad people without getting angry, or to begin to see that the whatever nature, bad nature we see in them is actually coming from us, when that begins to happen, then we try to get the most out of it. You know, this bad person I'm encountering right now, what should I do right now to change my mind as to how I view them? And you think about that. And you make a little bit of a change. So the idea is that we put ourselves in the position of encountering bad people on purpose. Why? So we can begin to develop a good heart. That's why we do it. I've told the story sometimes. Reba Rinpoche did not leave Tibet when His Holiness did. He stayed behind for a while. And he was imprisoned for maybe 10 months. And he was beaten. He lost all his teeth, for example. They were knocked out of his mouth. But he said the first time he was beaten, he realized at some point that he was not being angry, that he was practicing bodhicitta. And so, and this really made him happy, and he then prayed to be beaten more so he could practice more, make his practice much more effective. That's the kind of thing. So then bad people that we can react properly for are very hard to find. So we have to put ourselves in situations where we can find them, you know. We put ourselves in situations so that we can stop reacting in the wrong way toward bad people. So we can learn the proper way to do them. And by doing that, we can then stop the karma of meeting bad people again. And so another idea of this verse is that the more we practice, the fewer bad people we're going to be around. Why? Because our karma for meeting them is not going to be there. But until we're enlightened, we still have to find bad people in order to get rid of the last vestiges of our mental afflictions. And this would apply also to removing the knowledge obstacles once we reach nirvana, the seventh bodhisattva ground. So we're only going to cover the first four verses of the eight verses today. So if there are any questions, now is a good time to have them.
I have a question about the duck in the first verse. So the duck it's referring to, it's not the self-existing duck, me.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Why would that be so?
Because if it would be the self-existing one,
that's the correct start.
Then I would be able to help all sentient beings.
Well, if it were the self-existing duck, it could never change.
Oh, okay.
And it would never exist in the first one.
That's true. And it never has existed. Anybody else? Well, you're either all asleep or...
No, it was a...
Inspired.
It was a very clear teaching.
Neat. These are wonderful. I think we're going to, one of the later ones, we're going to have a teaching in four lines. They're short.
Venerable Phil, I have a question.
Yes.
Why don't we know or feel how tantric enlightenment could look like? Wouldn't it be easier if we kind of would be able to sense how it would be?
We have an idea of what it might be. But consider when you first met the Dharma. Did you really have any idea of what enlightenment might be compared to what you know now?
No.
So this goes. Now, as I said, you know, if you've been doing this for a few years, then you probably do have a pretty good idea. But I can tell you, you know, having studied in Italy for 7 years, and I mean, we even studied Tantra at an intellectual level there. You know, I had no idea what might be happening, the things that happened after I got to Diamond Mountain. Even for the first year, which was the 3-day-long courses before we actually got our empowerments, there were things happening that I'd never even dreamed of. So, yeah, we have an idea, I think. You know, I mean, we wouldn't be going for it if we didn't have some idea. I mean, there'd be sense to do that, you know.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Well, next week we'll do the next four verses, the 8 verses. And I think we're doing one more there too. So have a good week.
Thank you so much, Venerable Phil.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Venerable Phil. Bye.